This episode of the Pre-PT Grind podcast is brought to you by Kickstarter. Kickstart your pre-PT journey with all the basic essentials you need in order to get accepted into physical therapy school now. Kickstarter includes 15 video lessons to kickstart your application process. We cover all the basic fundamentals to set yourself apart from your competition and stand out. Highlights from the Kickstarter program include the perfect fit method, winning academics, a three-part interview series, 5 steps to the perfect letter of recommendation, and even PTCast hacks and much, much more. To find out more about Pre-PT Grind's Kickstarter program, visit us at www.preptgrind.com. www.preptgrind.com. Enjoy the episode. What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Pre-PT Grind podcast. This is where we help you decide, prepare, and transform into becoming not just the best DPT student you can be, but the best future physical therapist you can be as well. On this episode of the Pre-PT Grind podcast, I think we titled this pre-recording, Coming from the Dark Side, or whatever. We're talking about on this podcast what it is like on the other side of the table, the other side of the laptop, the other side of that email. What does it look like from the school's perspective, or the faculty, or the admissions perspective, when you shoot that email off, or when you call in, or when you apply to a school? Oftentimes we are so focused, so student focused and so student centered on, man, why don't they like this about my application? Why aren't they responding? Why not this? Why not that? This time on the podcast, we're going to focus and we're going to turn that light bulb around. We're going to turn that screen around and put you in that seat from someone who has been there themselves. So welcome to the podcast, Mr. Jeff Conan. We are so excited to have you drop some fire, to drop some knowledge, and to give us that perspective. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
All good. It's a little chilly up here in Chicago, but it's all good. It's not too cold yet, so I'm surviving.
That's great. I'm in Clearwater, St. Petersburg area. I'll try not to rub it in too much. Woo! For y'all.
Oh my goodness. Well, let's not rub it in. Let's get right into it. And let's start with, how did you even come across physical therapy? How did you get to where you're at now, or where you've been? What's kind of your background story to where you are now?
You know, my background is unique and different. And a lot of times when I talk to students, both wanting to be physical therapists or finishing PT school and wanting to establish a career, mine is not the traditional path you would follow. I found PT accidentally. I wasn't as lucky as many of the students nowadays who had great mentoring, such as what you guys are doing, to help them prepare and better understand the profession. I kind of stumbled into it. And I went through school, and I was fortunate enough to have a lot of good mentors from that point forward to help me in my career. And the career has allowed me to have clinical practice. It allowed me to get involved with scholarship, like writing books and writing articles, and then ultimately becoming a faculty member when I completed my PhD, and then eventually a program director in a physical therapy program. So I've been through all those phases that you guys talk about all the time, and it's great advice. And you and I connected as we talked about this, because the last part of my career to date has been on that so-called dark side, if you will, that you labeled, or the other side. Yeah. And that is, what do faculty or admissions committee people look at in these applications? And we had you and I had some great discussion prior to this podcast, and I look forward to sharing some of these ideas out here with your audience.
Perfect. So before we do that, talk a little bit about your pre-PT journey. You said it wasn't too traditional and things like that. Dive a little bit deeper into that. What was it like for you?
So my undergraduate degree decades ago was in physical education, as were most of us. We came up, we liked activity, we liked movement, we liked sports maybe, and I came to that route. I started in athletic training, which I still do as well as PT, and I was working in a clinical setting. And what I realized was that I always wanted more. I wanted to do more. I wanted to learn more. And through that process of growth, that led me through physical therapy school and then ultimately through a PhD program. And as you probably know nowadays, the grind of PT school is long, and it's difficult, and it's challenging, and it's rewarding. But less and less and less students nowadays finish PT school and then go on to get their PhD. And so I'll put a little plug in there that, in addition to maybe having an interest as becoming a physical therapist, boy, we could use some really good folks to then go down into the academic route down the road. But you're looking at, you know, a couple more years of school. And so that's the pathway that I went through, in addition to clinical practice in school, was to then decide, I want to teach, I want to do research, and I want to influence physical therapy on that side of the coin, particularly with the students and programs.
Now, what drew you to that research and academic side? Is there something that was wrong about the clinical side, or something just super powerful about that and drew you to that academic and research side? What was it?
I was a glutton for punishment because for some reason I just like to keep learning and staying in school. Actually, you know what? Actually, that's a great question. And my answer to that is very, very similar to the approach that you guys take with everyone who follows you. And here's what happened. Before I got my PhD, I was actually the author of textbooks, and I was invited to give presentations around the world. But every time I applied to teach, I was simply told, well, you can't teach, you don't have your doctorate degree.
Wow.
And I said, well, what does that mean? I'm qualified to do this. And the answer was, well, the doctorate gives you the credibility to publish and to present, and then more importantly, to be promoted in a university or academic setting. So it was a similar thing. Well, you're not qualified, I kept hearing, to do something. Wow. And that just fueled the fire to figure out how to do it.
Oh my, wow. That's super deep. But before that, how did you get into writing textbooks?
So I hope none of my former professors are watching and listening right now. But in my time in physical therapy school, one class, which I'll keep nameless at this time, we used a textbook that I never opened, and I never thought it was valuable, and it was not written in a user-friendly manner, and I used it more for probably a doorstop than anything else. And so when I graduated that very next year, I wrote letters to every publisher and said, I'd like to write a textbook on this topic. And of course, I got the same rejections, right? Well, who are you? You just graduated. You don't know anything. And I said, I'm your end user. And I'm the person who didn't find the other products helpful that we were all buying. And that's how it started. So eventually, a publishing company gave me a chance. And I wrote a book. And that was 24 books ago. Everything you guys do, right? It's all about perseverance. It's don't take no for an answer all the time. And eventually, if you find that door that opens, you walk into it and take advantage of it.
So you started writing textbooks right after PT school?
1 year out of school.
What?
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Well, kind of take us through that. You didn't like the product or whatever books you were using in PT school. Then where did you start? What kind of subject did you dive into? Was it kind of an all-encompassing book?
You're going to get me in trouble now. You're going to get me in trouble if I say the subject. So truthfully, the subject was kinesiology. It was in biomechanics.
Okay.
And at the time, there were two very, very good books on that topic, but they were just not user-friendly to the students. Mm-hmm. Students weren't opening the books and understanding the biomechanical formulas and how to better be a clinician from the books. And so that was my message to the publishers. It was, well, I'm not a professional writer, but I can help you change the idea of the concepts, and you have technical writers in your publishing company, so let's work together and do this. They already knew the market. They knew what the size of the market was, and they knew book sales, and so they gave me an opportunity. And again, you know, you never know until you ask, and if you never ask, you'll never have an opportunity.
So let me ask you this, because yes, you were on the quote unquote dark side of the faculty and admissions, but this is actually super interesting. I never thought we would go down this road before the podcast, but in regards to studying, since you know, have written textbooks that we study from and take tests from, not just in pre-PT land and PT school, from your side of the coin, how is it best to kind of study those concepts that you've actually written about? What's your take on it?
Oh, you have to use them, right? reading, you will retain so much information. And when you take what you learned and you apply it to practice, it becomes secondhand knowledge to you. It's not something you're memorizing or trying to regurgitate. It's an application process. So when you become a physical therapist, and let's say you take your first continuing education course, and perhaps it's in manual therapy or vestibular rehabilitation, and you learn so much information in 2 to 3 days of action-packed material, and you're excited to go back to work Monday morning, if you don't apply it right away on your patients, you will forget what you learned. It will sit in the book and will sit in the back of your mind somewhere. So it's like anything else. And that was my concept behind the type of books that I wanted to write, or that, yes, I understand science, I understand it has to be evidence-based, but more importantly, they have to be user-friendly so that the student can pick it right back up and apply that information as soon as they can. So let me ask you this. How many students have you come by, maybe you included, it was certainly me, where they would say, well, I'm just not a good written test taker, but give me the patient. I can give me the practical exam, right? I can do it. Mm-hmm. You hear this all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea, was how do we best translate a written book to the practical concept where people know they can do it. Now, certainly there's students the other way around who really are good at reading and memorizing and have phenomenal retention and then struggle in the practical sense. But those weren't the group of people I was addressing, because I wasn't one of those lucky students. I didn't have a photographic memory. I needed to learn how to apply to be able to learn what I was being taught.
So, I mean, you're hitting on, like you said, you're hitting on kind of the same concepts, the overall themes that we talk about all the time. You took your struggles and turned your passion into a career or into profits or into, you know, your legacy. That's pretty crazy. And that's kind of what we've been doing here. You know, I didn't get accepted the first time, turn that passion into what it is now. And that just goes to show, whatever you're going through now, it's kind of like a compound effect for your future. That's just super powerful to hear from someone who has been in the game for so long.
Well, you learn from your adversity, right? You don't intentionally want to entertain adversity, but it's how you respond to it that will really drive your opportunities. And I, you know, I didn't get into PT school the first go around. And I'll tell you how I didn't get in, because my GREs were 10 points too low for the minimal acceptance. So think about how many people get frustrated about they don't like GREs. And the grad school's GREs were all looking for a minimum of 1,000. And it was a black and white hardline score. And I scored 990. And I took them again. And I scored 990 again. And I'm asking the question, like everybody else is asking, right? What do GREs have to do with becoming a good physical therapist? And maybe that's a valid question. Maybe there are really good answers, which we'll probably dive into tonight, as to why schools still have GREs and how important they are for the applicant.
Yeah, let's dive into that right now. Talk about it. Why does it matter? Why is it there? And what are they even looking at when they want to see those scores?
Sure. So everyone should really know this. If every school were looking for the exact same thing in all the candidates, it would be an easy process to predict, because the same people would get into all the same schools and all the others wouldn't get into any schools. But the truth of the matter is every school looks for certain similarities in students and certain differences in students. And you know, some schools require GREs and some schools don't require GREs, and there's various reasons for that. But what all schools try to do, whenever they accept a student, it's an investment for everybody. And the schools understand that, and they're invested in every single student the day they accept them. To get to the acceptance point, The schools then have a responsibility. And this is a predictive responsibility. So what they look at are what are the successful predictions of an individual's application or portfolio. So for example, if you look at all their perhaps their overall GPA or their GPA in their prerequisites or their GPA in their major or their GPA in their last 60 junior and senior year credits or their GRE scores, any of those quantitative numbers, for example. And then you match those over the course of time to how students do in the program. Is there a correlation to any of those numbers to how they perform in gross anatomy, which oftentimes is the first class? Is there a correlation to overall retention rate? Is there a correlation to licensure pass rate? And the schools, though they may or may not tell you those detailed informations, they know internally. So most schools that require GREs, they use the GREs because it's one of the predictive modeling values that say, it's important to us because a GRE score, even though you might say it has nothing to do with how you manage a patient, for whatever the reason is, when we've run our statistics, it's one of the highest predictors of success for students in the curriculum. So for all the students that are out there as applicants and say, I'm frustrated, I don't do well on GREs, I don't understand why you tell me that I need to take them, that's the reason why. So it's not just about taking the GRE and meeting the minimum score that they tell you, just like if they tell you the minimum score is a GPA of 3.2, but their applicant average sometimes may be higher because of the size of the pool, you still want to do as high of a score as best you possibly can on GREs if you're applying to a school that requires them, because they're going to look at the value of that score. It means something to them. Schools that don't require GREs, there's a number of reasons. Maybe in their predictive modeling, GREs weren't critically important to them. Maybe they see it as an extra hardship or burden on a student applicant. Maybe it's a school for whatever the reason. So schools with higher tuitions, which typically are the private schools, they might reduce that one additional burden of cost to students. They also may have an overall smaller applicant pool because of the cost of the tuition. So they might remove GREs as a barrier, and they've looked at other predictors that are important to them. And those aren't oftentimes advertised outwardly to applicants. So it's really up to the applicants to find out the strength of their application by doing as much as they can to meet with program faculty or admissions committee and see if they can learn what they feel are really, really important from their perspective. There's a lot of people who think that the first course in a program is a quote-unquote weed-out course, like a gross anatomy. There's no weed-out courses. When a program accepts students, they're not accepting them to see if they can weed them out. They've reviewed all the applicants and say, hey, you're one of the best. We're going to do everything we can to help you survive. We've done our job to say we think you're one that will succeed through here. It just so happens that attrition occurs and some people don't do well in their first class. But it's up to the applicant to find out where they fit in and match best. GREs just aren't randomly put on the application process for no reason.
Wow. So there's so much to unpack from that, but let's go into a little bit about the attrition rates and how much that affects the school from like a number standpoint, financial standpoint, and how other students look at them and how the outside world looks at them. Why are they so afraid of that attrition rate?
Wow. So there's a couple ways to answer that, right? So first of all, we will typically publicly make known what is our retention rate, what is our licensure pass rate, what is our job placement rate. That's important for schools to publicly make aware of others and for applicants to know when you're applying to schools. If I'm an applicant and a school is losing 25% of its students that they admitted before they graduate, I just need to ask hard questions. Why is that happening? It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing, because there might be some odd years where students had particular hardships. There might have been health issues. There might have been family issues. There might have been financial issues. That happens. So you just want to ask really good questions. Why is your attrition rate at 85% of retention and 15% of students every year are not passing or not continuing, I should say? They may be passing and just withdraw. So that's the one thing to ask that question. It may it may raise a red flag for you. It may not. It may have a really good answer behind it. But the way I looked at it, though, was if we didn't do a good job of picking the students that we thought were going to succeed and one didn't succeed, someone lost that opportunity that we didn't pick. And hopefully they got into a school someplace else.
Wow.
But we have an empty seat sitting there. And certainly I could say, well, gosh, that's, I can do the math, how much tuition we lose over the next year or two. But that's not really as important to me. Maybe the upper administration would look at the numbers. For me, it was, there's an empty seat here. And if we lose somebody in the first semester and they can't continue, we didn't do a good job, maybe partly of picking the right people. Maybe they weren't prepared. Maybe they didn't transition well. There's so many different reasons. But it's not uncommon to have, you know, depending on the size of your class, students not succeed through. The difference of, if you think about the transition students have from high school to college, right, that freshman year, all the different things you have to learn and how to adjust to study. This is like, what, fivefold, tenfold, going from undergrad to grad school and PT. So you're now taking anywhere up to 21 or 22 credits of grad school a semester. And most of us cheat and add more information than we need to anyways and just treat you like a sponge until you start overflowing. So retention is important for all those reasons, but most importantly, it really falls back on the faculty. That's why we have an application process to do our due diligence to screen who we think, and I'm going to say this really carefully, not who we think are the best students. So let's say we have an admissions class of 50 students.
Wow.
We're not looking to find the best 50 students. What? We're looking to find the best 50 students that make the best diverse class for us. Because if all 50 have GPAs of 4.0 and phenomenal GREs, but there is no diversity in that class. And when I say diversity, I'm not talking about just, you know, race or religion. I'm talking about geography. Where did they come from? What type of undergraduate experience do they have? Small school, large school? What were their majors? Are they first-generation students into graduate school as a PT? Do they come from a family life? Well, everyone comes from different backgrounds, and that's what makes the class a good class, not just everyone looks the same and is the best student on paper. So when we sit around as a faculty from school to school, there will always be the creme de la creme, the students that rise to the top, and they're on everyone's school's radar, they're going to be accepted. And then, unfortunately, there are those group of students that they applied, their GPA's low, the GRE's low, whatever it might be, they're just not at the top of the list. And then you have those students that are on that bubble. And those are the students that always say, well, how could I have possibly gotten into this school, but I can't get into that school? And it all comes down to that group of faculty and admissions committee sitting around a table and saying, okay, not only do we think they can make it in our program, but how do they fit in now with the beginning group of students we added to continue to make this class more and more diverse and make it stronger and richer that way? You have no control over that as an applicant, right? You have no idea.
That's crazy.
You have no idea. So as an applicant, you always want to do your homework. What do I think this school is looking for in terms of its diversity? How do I fit into that program? And the downside of this, PT CAS has made it too easy to not do that homework, right? Because before PT CAS, we would fill out a 10-page application. And I'm going to make darn sure well that I have an interest in this school and I think I can get in and I know enough about it before I spend all this time doing this paperwork. But now I just click a button and add another school and click a button and add another school and maybe pay another small amount.
Wow.
And I haven't really done my homework. And I can tell you, being on that dark side, that I've interviewed students on campus who were granted interviews in the top of the pool of applicants. And they were very honest and said, well, I didn't know anything about your school, but there were no additional application fees. Tuition overall was lower than most others, so I'm just going to check the box. Now I'm here, I'm going to learn about it. That's not a good way to convince faculty you want to be in their program. So I think PT CAS, it's been efficient and it's been helpful on one end, but but it's taken the legwork of homework and preparation that we look for on the admissions side from the other end. Students are less prepared unless they do their homework. It's too easy to check that box.
My goodness. I have a little page of notes here. I don't even know what direction to go in. I knew this podcast was going to be fire, but oh my goodness. So let's go the PTCast route since you mentioned that last. How does that work from your side? And because we get a lot of questions about, okay, I've been accepted multiple places. Will it look bad if I tell them I got, you know, offered this place and that place? Will they reject me if I do this? And what goes on in your mind from that perspective for those students?
Wow. That's a great question. And you guys and your applicants probably know a lot more of those details about the intrinsics and the technology of PTCast. What I can tell you, at least from my experience, there's no bias based on that at all. Where the bias comes in is not through PTCast, but it's through what has been created now that's called traffic rules. And everyone applying to school should learn about the traffic rules. It's not mandatory, but it's highly recommended and encouraged, and it comes from ACAPT, A-C-A-P-T, which is an organizing body that oversees the PT programs in terms of development, curricular advice, things of that nature. It's a branch within APTA. But essentially what was happening was this. If you apply to multiple schools, which you may encourage many folks that you mentor to do so, then all the schools could set, number one, their own guidelines. What do they charge for a deposit, right? So now you're laying down $1,000 here, $1,500 there. You're putting all this money down, and you're trying to make a decision where you're going to go. All the schools have different start dates, right? And it's a game of roulette, basically. So what the admission rules, the traffic rules basically said was, we need to do two things. We need to protect the students a little more so they're not just throwing all this money away because school's too expensive. So there was a cap put on the amount that you can require as a deposit. And then there was a certain date put down that said you can't ask for a deposit any sooner than this date. They tried to shorten the window so the students weren't stretched out over the multiple schools. Now, the traffic rules are not so much beneficial for schools that have either a rolling admissions or multiple cohorts a year, because the traffic rules were really put in place for a singular type admission program. But here's what would happen. Let me explain this to you why they were put in place too. The first part, as I mentioned, was to help the student not have, as an applicant, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 of unrefundable deposits thrown down because you're waiting to find out from your top choice and they're the last one down the line to hear from. Schools do not coordinate, collaborate, conspire with each other. They work according to their own timelines, their own curricular sequence, their own university calendar. And unfortunately, there are so many different ones to look at when you're an applicant. But the other thing that was happening was this. You would have a student take a spot in a program, and they would actually start the program in the summer. And they would enroll in, say, a gross anatomy course or another course in the first official semester. And they would be in this program, and they would take a seat. And then during that time, they would hear from another school that is on a later timeline. And that school started classes in September. And this student was on the wait list, and they got a call that said, hey, congratulations, you're off the wait list. We'd like to offer you a spot. And what would happen is, if this school that offered them a spot off the wait list was a significantly lower tuition-paying school, maybe their in-state school versus where they chose to take a seat up now, that student would leave the next day. They would just leave, and they would give up the money they spent in that summer course, because more than likely the courses wouldn't transfer, and they would have to take them over at this other school. And they would leave, because for the $5,000 or $6,000 or so tuition they lost that summer, they're spending $10,000 to $15,000 less a year for 3 years and maybe living closer in this other school. But what happened to the program that lost a student in the summer? They have an empty seat now for the next 3 years. Because you can't put somebody in the fifth week of gross anatomy. So the traffic rules were designed to stop that from occurring also, so that if you as a student matriculated in a school and took a seat, that would be noted on PTCAS, right? So other schools would then not offer you that seat to come in and pull you away. They weren't doing anything intentionally. They weren't, you know, pirating or stealing students from other programs. They were working along their timeline. Student's name came up off a wait list. So there's some advantages to PTCAS. There's really no bias, I don't think, from the faculty. I know one of the things I see a lot pop up on your site with questions are, how do faculty interpret partially completed applications or courses that they haven't taken yet, they'll take in the last semester while they're still applying. You know, every school treats those differently. Typically, if you're a strong applicant and you just have to take another class or two in your last semester of school, then you would be accepted on the contingency that you would successfully pass those classes. But if you have more than two, say three outstanding prerequisites or other things that are missing, GRE scores with no score at all, then it's up to the school on an independent basis to make their decisions to say, okay, we have, you know, another 150 applicants who have complete applications. We really have to focus on them and reward those people. And we can't then ignore one of them and bypass them for you to wait to see how you do for three classes in the rest of the semester.
So it sounds like, okay, there's not really a bias, or there's nothing bad about being offered multiple positions at schools. It's just when you accept one school, then they are notified so the school can move on to another deserving applicant.
When you are accepted, it's noticeable there, but the idea is when you actually matriculate and start in that program, that ethically the goal is that you'll stay in that program and you won't switch then to another one and lose that seat that someone else could have had. And again, the tuition for the school for 3 years, essentially.
Gotcha. Makes perfect sense. So all of this, it sounds like, from if I'm reading between the lines, it sounds like the applicants nowadays, or, you know, last year, years coming from now, they need a non-traditional way of applying to PT school. Their mindset needs to be not the same as it used to be. Their strategies, their tactics need to be non-traditional. They can't just go on PTCAS and pick a couple schools, say, I'm applying to 15, let's just take a shot and see if we can get in. You have to be very diligent, very strategic, and you have to do it in a new way that has been either told to you before or that you just found on YouTube or found on a blog. It has to be more than that, is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, I think you have to have an open mind. And again, you have to understand the difference between all the schools and what is the school looking for, and are you a match for that school? So for example, if you apply to a school that does not conduct interviews, that's taking away one piece of an application process. If your strength is your interpersonal skills as one of the things you bring to the table, you're losing out on that opportunity to showcase yourself. What it also means is there must be a heavier placement put on numbers. So it's going to start out on, right, GPAs, GREs, all those things. So if you don't do well in that area, and I say don't do well, let's say you have a 3.3, which is good. I'd take a 3.3 out of a 4.0. But considering there might be 200 or more applicants higher than you in the GPA range, and if you have a 3.3, if you have great interpersonal skills, but there's no interview process at that school, you're likely starting on the lower end of a range of rankings. The flip side of that is, if you do interview well, and that's one of your strengths, and let me add this. This is something I see a lot. It's not for you as the applicant to determine if that's your strength. It's for you to get good, honest feedback and criticism from people you trust to say, one of your strengths is this. So when you then go interview, you got to the table. You got to the interview. If you can get to the interview, that's kind of the admissions committee's way of saying, we think you could survive here academically. So the next thing is, now we look at everybody's interpersonal skills, how they interact with each other, how well did you prepare for the interview, did you ask good questions, did you answer our questions well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But too many people will tell you, have you heard this before, where someone will say, hey, listen, one of the things I really want to tell you is, you don't respond to criticism too well. And they say, yes, I do. That's not true. So there will be people who think they interview well and they have good interpersonal skills, and they may not. They may not even be aware of fidgety habits or other things that come across as not being overly impressive. And so from that standpoint, that's how you screen as a beginning tool, which schools do I want to think about? And you have to put away your own personal bias. You may love the school and say, I want to go to the school. I'm going to apply anyways. But then you have to be honest with yourself up front and know, where are your strengths? Are they on paper with your GPA? Are they with your interpersonal skills during interviews? Is it because of your life experiences that you bring to the table? What you guys talk about all the time is your passion. You know, demonstrate to people your realism, who you are. A lot of times, you know, there are some real times I want to hear people tell me what I want to hear on the other side, not just what they say. And I'll tell you the reason why. If your passion is I want to be a PT because I want to help people, Do you know how many times we hear that?
Boring.
So your I want to help people needs to be really over the edge passionate to convince me I need to hear it. And the same with essays, when you write essays. If I'm on reading essay 400, or quite frankly, essay 30 by that time, and it says I want to help people, it has to be really, really compelling. And again, I'm not saying don't be honest. You guys talk all the time about being passionate, tell them the truth and what you feel. And that's great if you believe you can do it convincingly enough to be different from everyone else that's saying the same thing. So I would assume, you know, I've never read an essay where someone says, I don't want to work with people. That's why I'm going into PT. So if you tell me you're going into it because you want to work with people, that's the bare minimum. That's the lowest bar possible for me to consider you. So convince me more. What do you know about the field? What do you know about where healthcare is headed? Throw out some buzzwords of interprofessionalism or, you know, things of that nature, right? So if you demonstrate you've done some of your homework, and quite frankly, we can all simply log on to the APTA homepage and on the first page scroll down and see what the top issues are in the profession, and throw those out, but not in a memorized way, but in the same meaningful passion way that you've learned it, studied it, and it resonated with you. And if you see a topic that doesn't resonate with you, that's not the one you pretend to write about. Find one that you really like that's triggering you.
Man, so what I'm getting from this is that everybody wants to get accepted, but not a lot of people want to put that work in. Everybody wants to achieve their success of getting into PT school, but a lot of people don't put in that real effort, that real work, that real time commitment to really understand their choice of school that they're applying to and really convey to that school that you're truly interested in them, like dating. If you're going on a date with someone, you have to really be invested for them to want to marry you or take that next step. You have to put that work in for your school. So you got to keep it very narrow and focused. And that's what I think a lot of pre-PTs don't do.
And I'm not going to blame the people for not putting the work in. I'm going to blame them for not knowing that they need to put the work in. The very reason you guys are successful at doing what you're doing is because there's a gap out there. The advising in undergraduate or pre-PT preparation is absent. It's significantly absent.
Exactly.
Right? And so you don't know what you don't know.
Boom.
And it's not until someone knocks on your door or you stumble upon someone and says, wow, I didn't know I have to do all this. You know, the bottom line is applying to a PT school is a game. And what you have to do is figure out what are the rules of the game.
Ooh.
And most of the rules are transparent. But a lot of the rules, they differ. And you do have, that's where you have to do your homework and learn from others through the process. Learn from people who successfully got in. Learn from people who successfully finished. Learn from people who didn't get in. There's a lot of folks, you and I in this group, right? You don't get in your first time. You know, the number of people I saw that reapplied. If you just click the button again and submit the same paperwork, isn't that the definition of insanity? Keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. So what did you do different the second go around, right? How did you convince me that not getting in last year triggered something to tell you need to be a different applicant? Why, how, where, and then sell that, rewrite essays, make that your essay. I didn't get in last year, and here's what I did to convince you I want to be here. And that's the first question you're going to get. Because if you, especially if you get an interview and you don't get in, that's the first question. I can throw all my interview questions away. Say, tell me what did you do between last year and this year when you did not get in that should convince me you should be here? And if you hit that question out of the park, that's perseverance to me. That's part of what it takes as a skill set to succeed in PT school. So that's very convincing.
Jeez, that was fire. The definition of insanity. Are many pre PTs insane? That just kind of blew my mind. Are a lot of pre PTs insanely applying? Are they insanely applying to PT school? Just doing the same thing over and over again? Oh,
my God. And this is the fault of technology. It's too easy. It's too easy to do it again.
Goodness. I had a question I wrote down. Since you're on the other side, do you have any pet peeves when you see applications come across, essays, interviews? What are some, I guess, fun or funny pet peeves that you really can't stand?
Wow. So I've oftentimes thought that this would be one of the books that I write, but I'd have to be really, really careful not to expose people because they'll know who they are. So let's start with the written piece of it, okay? The written piece is what I just mentioned. This is not really funny, but it's a pet peeve, which I think was the original part of the question. And the pet peeve is just telling you you want to help people, and that's why you want to become a physical therapist. That's the first thing. If I were to read 400 applications, I'd probably see that in 300 out of the 400. The other 100 are also predictable for the most part. It was because I was an athlete and I got hurt and I did physical therapy and I liked that. And is it a pet peeve? It's just not original. It might be truthful. You might be passionate about it. It might be the exact reason why you chose it. But again, if I read that a lot of times, it doesn't put you in a different category of other candidates. And that's part of your essay that is reviewed, right? That makes, this is your chance. Tell me anything you want to tell me in that essay. And if you tell me something that's the same as 55 other people, it's just not resonating. So to me, it's a pet peeve because I think everyone could and should do better as part of doing your homework to know how to convince me what I'm looking to read. The third answer that's most commonly seen is very similar to that. It's not yourself, but it was a relative. You know, parent, somebody had a stroke or a heart attack, and I saw the PTs in the hospital, and that got me excited watching them treat people and get them better. So the written piece, that's it. Now, if you see really bad typos, one of the things that we see, unfortunately, it's just absolutely unbelievable, but if you use, like, text words in your essays, so you are, instead of Y-O-U-R for your, you will see that. There's too many people now, right? We communicate with our thumbs through our text, and it's just almost automatically comes out like that when you're writing narratively. So when you see that, that's kind of embarrassing because you should have proofed it. I can't stop you from having other people proof it for you. So it should be spotless from errors, and errors like that especially. If in your essays or things you say or write are either not factual, like you mix up the schools, that happens too. My essay is, I want nothing more than to be a student at the University of whatever, and you didn't change your essay, that's for a different school, for a supplemental letter or something. That's probably a pet peeve. And then I typically would read and say, oh, well, then good luck to you. I wish you can get into that school also. And you should have paid more attention to detail. The one thing that's a really big pet peeve, sort of red flag, are when you have recommendation forms from volunteer hours, if you will, and those aren't good. Because if you don't know what they're going to say about you, and you don't know why you're not getting to a program, and I know, and the reason is this person who keeps giving you a recommendation, it's not a good one, but you don't know that, your application is almost sabotaged right from the beginning. So one of the things I will encourage all the applicants to do, this is not easy to do, but this demonstrates a level of maturity, and it saves you a whole lot of headaches down the road. You ask the people who are writing your letters of recommendation, what will you say about me? What will you tell them about me? You also might take it a step further and know what each particular school is looking for in their students, and then tell those folks, this school here is really looking for this. I've met their faculty. This is what they shared with me. Can you please address that in your letter and tell me what you would say? Now, there's two reasons why you do that. It's really hard to do. I understand. One is, if you don't know what they're going to say, and they're giving you low scores on a rubric, or they're saying things that, you know, this person didn't really come into the clinic on time, most of those letters are slam dunks. We would assume that you can find two or three people to tell us you can walk on water and you're the best person they've ever met. So anything that's less than that when we read that almost puts you in another pile and gives us reason for concern. So if they're telling you that, you know, I think you're really good, but I do need to tell them two of the 10 times you came to volunteer, you were late or you were inappropriately dressed. I need to note that. I would run and not use that person. Find somebody else to write your letter. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you come to the interview phase, I'm going to ask you questions specifically about those things. I'm not going to ask you. I'm past the time of saying, what do you think are your strengths and weaknesses, especially when you volunteered? What I'm going to ask you is, if I were to call up this person who you volunteered with, what would they tell me about you? And I'm hoping, honestly, that you have some really good self-awareness, and what you're going to tell me is exactly what they told me. So either you don't have good self-awareness if it doesn't match, or you're not telling the truth, and neither of those are good outcomes. Now, a really bad outcome, but I can live with, is if they say, well, they'll probably say I did a really good job, but I was late for 2 days, or I wore jeans 2 days and I shouldn't have. I love that honesty. I love that. And I know that you know that you had an open line of communication with them. You're comfortable at a mature level to talk to them about this, and you still let them write your letter. So as crazy and as bad as that might sound, now, that's me. I'm an N of one. There might be other people on the dark side who look at that and say, oh, no, never mind. We're not. There's no way. But listen, I've had people show up to interviews in pajamas, in flops, you name it. And various forms of facial jewelry. And that's another thing you want to know. So if you come in and you have, you're a male and you have your ears pierced, if you're with me interviewing, I'm fine. I look past that. Doesn't bother me. I do tell you that there might be some clinical sites you're assigned to, and they may require you to remove that. And at a job in the future, they might require you to remove that. That's up to them. But from my standpoint, I'm not interviewing the jeweler in your ear. I'm looking at you more holistically, right? However, again, I'm an N of one. There might be some people on the admissions committee or the faculty that say, that's not appropriate in this day and age. You're trying to send a message. You're trying to be too much individual. You should have at least taken it out for the interview. You can't control that at all. So you have a choice. You try to speculate, which is not easy to do, what they're going to guess or say or what their philosophies are, or you just take a high road and you don't play that game. If your goal is to really get into PT school, you have a choice. Okay, I'm taking the jewelry out and I'm going to go absent that and not raise any doubt in any voting member's mind, or I'm keeping it in. I'm me. And if they don't like me for who I am, that's okay. I'm okay with all of the above. But you as an applicant need to know that those are all the possibilities that could come out to play. And I'm okay if you want to be yourself. I'm okay if you want to be someone totally different. I joke around students all the time when they come to, I'd say about the fifth day of class, they no longer worry about how they look, right? They're coming in, no hair comb, no makeup, sweatpants, all those things. And I'm looking at their interview picture that day. I said, you guys don't look anything like the day you showed us on the interview, right? So it's the interview day and it's the graduation. You see these two different people and everything in between. Who knows? But again, I personally don't care, but I'm a little bit more open-minded, receptive to that. But there are some other people who have strong views on those. And that's up to the applicant to partially kind of know. How do you know this? Well, you can ask, right? If you're close enough in proximity to visit schools and meet with faculty, you can look at some of the research some of the faculty do. You might even find out some of the papers they write have to do with certain behavioral patterns or things of that nature. Who knows? That's all part of the homework process. right? Learn as much as you can about a place you're applying to and the people that work there.
Man, my goodness. So, man, you guys have to find a different way to look at things and a different way to apply and a different way to do things. Whether that's us, I really only see us as the only people who are looking at it from a different perspective, thinking outside the box. So if you need to come to us, you know where to find us. But if this has not sinking in from anything, I don't know what else to tell you. But from coming from the dark side, coming from the horse's mouth, he is telling you exactly what you need to do. He is telling you exactly what you need to do. And if this podcast is not enough, email us, message us, get into one of our courses and one of our programs. We will tell you everything you need to do. But this is not from us anymore. This is not just us rambling and talking. This is Dr. Jeff Conan laying down the fire. So you guys got it.
You guys do a great job of helping people now know what, as I said earlier, what's not out there, where they're not finding help at the places they're going to school, or they've already graduated. Now they have nowhere to turn. So you're it. You're it.
Yep.
Keep doing what you're doing. It's great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. Because not to bash any advisors, because I had a great pre-PT advisor, but a lot of times the traditional advisor or guidance counselor has many students from many different majors. They're just doing their job. They're looking at the numbers and they're telling you what they think is best. And it's not a bad thing, but they are not specific to what you need. So we're here for you for everything you need, specifically PT. You guys already know that, just hammering it down. But Jeff, if you were to go back and talk to the younger pre-PT version of yourself, because there might be a younger Jeff Conan out there wanting to write textbooks and be in academia, what advice would you tell him with everything you know now about the pre-PT experience?
Wow. First of all, just know that it's what you want to do, right? Just like any other career decision, you're about to get into something for 50 years or so to work. Make sure you're doing what you want to do and stay passionate and stay the course. And always, 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 you're never too old. The game never ends of learning and listening to others. So stay mentored through the whole process. Some advice you'll get will be really good. Some won't be so good. Put it all together. You make your decision. Stay the course and don't doubt yourself. But when you need to be passionate, right? And find that passion well before the process. Know that there's challenges through school. So you have to figure out ways to stay passionate through school, and there's a rainbow at the end somewhere. And then you have to find the same kind of passion when you're out practicing, because there are things that are going to frustrate you, right? There's going to be reimbursement issues, documentation issues, you name it. But that's not what you focus on, and that's not what you got into the profession. So know right from the beginning, my passion's here. I'm going to do everything I can to succeed every step of the way. And you know what that comes down to? It comes down to a decision on a regular basis, right? So it's Friday night, and should I study for this chemistry test on Monday or go out with my buddies? Well, the grade on the chemistry test leads to the grade for the chemistry course, which is one of the major prerequisite courses that we look at. So it's really about decision-making on a regular basis and just simply doing the right thing.
Man, and this is probably, you're probably one of the most perfect people to answer this question. If you had your own PT school, what are you looking for, and what's your most ideal applicant that you would accept into your program?
So, okay, there's no ideal candidate, because everybody brings different things to the table that all can, as I mentioned earlier, contribute to a diverse class. What I do want to see is exactly what I just mentioned. I want somebody to demonstrate the passion and the commitment and the work ethic, because how you prepare up to PT school, everything, not just GREs and GPAs, but the comments people make about you, your life experiences, what you've done in your free time, all of these things tell me about you, and they tell me who I'm getting in PT school. There's no magic bullet to that, honestly. You know, my background in PT is orthopedics and sports. So I love that. But if we brought in every student was an ortho sport interested person, we'd be missing a big part of the overall profession. And I have to tell you, the number of folks that came into a program that were ortho sport and we clicked, and then before 3 years were over, they told me they're switching to neuro or peds or cardiac. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you can't do that to me. But so it's really, really hard to pinpoint a single thing that everyone should have, except for that passion and that work ethic to get through. And then the rest of it is we just want to see, you know, a diverse set of everything, characteristics, backgrounds, whatever that people bring that can make the class on a daily basis fun.
Wow. Wow. And man, you dropped so much fire that there's probably plenty of students who want to, I don't know, reach out to you or ask you more questions. If you're open to that, where can they either learn more information about you or reach out to you?
You know what? Maybe when this is over and we post the podcast, we'll connect out there and we'll put my information on. And I'm more than happy to help out. And, you know, I'm a small supplement to all the stuff that you guys are doing. I follow everything you're doing. It's phenomenal. And I think I just add a little piece to say, okay, here's what's going on that other side that I think can help people understand as well. And listen, you could probably pick any faculty member from all over the country and they'll come on and they'll give you similar, maybe different advice, because we won't all agree as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. So the more, as we said, the more mentoring, the more advice, the better. But I'm happy to share my information for contact purposes, but I'm going to continue to help support you guys in doing what you're doing. This is your gig, and it's a great, great service. You're helping a lot of people.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I am extremely, extremely humbled. And you guys know where to find us. If you're looking for us and you can't, then you're not looking hard enough. www.preptgrind.com. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Pre-PT Grind podcast. We will see you on the next one. Take care. This episode of the Pre-PT Grind podcast was brought to you by Kickstarter. Did you know that you are losing $75,000 to $100,000 in lost physical therapy income when you do not get accepted into physical therapy school? Now times that by 2 or 3 if it takes you 2 or 3 times to apply. If you do not want to lose $75,000 to $100,000 in lost physical therapy income by not getting into PT school, then you need to join Kickstarter. Kickstarter includes 15 video lessons to kickstart your application process. We cover the basic essentials to set yourself apart from your competition, to help you stand out, and to help you save $75,000 to $100,000. So get accepted, join Kickstarter, and find more information at www.preptgrind.com. See you on the next episode of the Pre-PT Grind podcast.